This is Science Show number 1992.
The flywheel is going down, which it should do, of course. We are there. It's done its job. We are on the comet.
This is a big step for human civilization. The biggest problem of success is that it looks easy.
The euphoria when Rosetta met the comet. Monica O'Grady from the Open University said the mission was 150% successful. So what happened next? Here's Jonathan Nally.
As bumpy rides go, this one was a long time coming. After a journey of 10 years and more than 500 million kilometres, Europe's tiny robot Philae touched down on comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko last week, not once, not twice, but three times. Philae bounced back into space twice because its main anchoring equipment didn't work. Two harpoons that would have held it in place didn't fire. And a small rocket thruster that would have helped push it down onto the surface didn't fire either. Both mechanisms were carried because, although the comet has gravity, it's not very strong, only about 1/10,000th of that here on Earth. An astronaut walking on the surface would be in danger of floating away if they simply flexed their knees too suddenly. Philae came to rest in a spot half in the sunlight and half in shadow, which sealed its fate. Its battery, intended to keep it alive only until it was safely settled on the comet, has now run out, and there's not enough charge coming in from the solar cells because they're not getting enough sunlight. So, with insufficient power, Philae has fallen silent. But not before sending back a bunch of images and drilling into the surface to test the comet's chemical nature and a few other tests. These were the main aims of its mission, and scientists are currently analysing the data. The comet itself is a huge mountain of ice and rocky rubble, about 8 kilometres long and shaped a bit like a peanut, or one of those toy bones you give to a dog. Still beyond the orbit of Jupiter, it's going to head closer in toward the Sun over the next 9 months. As it does, it's possible that Philae's solar cells might end up getting more sunlight, bringing the explorer back to life. Possible, but don't hold your breath. It's hard for equipment to stay usable after spending many months in the ultimate deep freeze of space. Meanwhile, Rosetta, the parent craft that carried Philae to the comet, is continuing with its own investigations. Slowly circling the comet, it is mapping the surface, studying the chemical makeup, beaming radar below the surface to learn about its structure, and analysing the gases given off as the comet heats up. Rosetta is going to stick close by as the comet heads sunward, giving it a box seat as the sun's warmth begins to sublime the ice and produce a gassy, dusty tail. Sublimation is when ice is heated, but bypasses the liquid stage and goes straight to a gas. Scientists are interested in comets because they're a bit like time capsules. They are thought to retain, in relatively pristine form, much of the original chemical mixture from which the solar system formed billions of years ago. So learning more about them will tell us more about our origins. They're interesting also because many scientists think that much of the water on Earth was brought here in the early days of the planets when comets were bombarding us left, right and centre. Which raises the third reason. Comets have hit us in the past, and at least one is bound to do so again in the future. In which case, we'll need to go out and deflect it. And for that, we need more information on what they're made of and how solid they are. Now, while Rosetta concentrates on one icy body in the middle part of the solar system, way out on the edge of town, another spacecraft is about to have its own close encounter with a frozen world. Pluto. NASA's New Horizons, launched in 2006 and the first mission ever sent to the planet, or dwarf planet as some people insist, is only 8 months away from giving us our first up-close look at this mysterious globe. Because very little is known about Pluto. We know how big it is, how far away it is, and what it's mostly made of, and that it has at least 5 moons. But that's about it. Even our best pictures, taken with Hubble, show nothing more than a blurry blob. So when New Horizons zips past in July next year, we'll get to see Pluto in detail at last. And maybe find more moons. Maybe even rings, like Saturn. It's going to be fantastic.
I'm sure you're right. Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Nally. Another fantastic revelation happened this week at the Natural History Museum in London. She's an ancient girl, but she's all there.
All right. Introduce me to Sophie. We're surrounded by Sophie in this room at the moment. On the benches that run around the walls, you'll see lots and lots and lots of big black and dark bound bones, and they are most of the skeleton of the most complete Stegosaurus ever found anywhere, which is nicknamed Sophie.
Where was it found?
So Sophie comes from a small town called Shell in Wyoming, and she was actually found on a ranch, Red Canyon Ranch, which is just outside of Shell, found by the ranch owners when actually digging a drainage trench. So they were digging a trench on their land with a little digger, suddenly realised they were digging through something that wasn't rock, and stopped the digger, and then realised they had this beautiful skeleton which was actually coiled up in the ground, and then they started a full-scale excavation.
And it does seem to have all the bones. Anything missing that you've particularly noticed?
She's about 90% complete. The only thing that's really missing that's a substantial lump is one of her front legs. One of the front legs seems to have been lost just through natural processes of erosion before she was buried. And then unfortunately, the only other bit of the skeleton that was lost is a bit of the base of the tail, which marks the bit where the digger found her.
Oh dear. And how do you know it's Sophie and not Stephen?
That's a really good question. We actually have no idea what the sex of the skeleton is. It's actually very difficult to sex dinosaurs. There's almost no reliable way of doing that. So she's nicknamed Sophie because that's the nickname of the donor's daughter.
How on earth did you get it out of America, let alone Wyoming? Because that's the mission central, apart from Northern Queensland, of finding great big dinosaurs. And it's here in South Kensington rather than the United States.
So Sophie was found on private land. It's owned by the ranchers, and they decided that they wanted to sell the specimen commercially. And it's perfectly legal to buy fossil specimens from private land in the US, assuming that you go through all the relevant customs procedures and so on. So Sophie was on the open market. Came to our attention when we were attending a big fossil fair in the US, and then we started a fundraising effort with our development department at the museum, who managed to find the donor, who was then able to get us the money to buy the skeleton.
Stegosaurus, you say? For those who are not 14-year-olds, what does it look like?
So Stegosaurus is probably one of the most recognisable dinosaurs, one of the ones you almost always find in those cereal packet model giveaway. So it's a four-legged dinosaur, quite a squat body, very small head, big barrel-shaped body, long tail, but the key thing about Stegosaurus is the big long plate of rhomboidal-shaped spines that run along her back, and the big tail spines at the end of the tail, which are probably used for defence. So a very characteristic dinosaur. I'm sure most people would recognise it if they saw a picture of it.
Mostly for defence, not for temperature control or anything like that?
Well, actually, the spines at the end of the tail are proper spines. They're long, they're pointed, would have been covered with a thick sheath of horny keratin, the same substance that makes up your fingernails. They're probably for defence. They've probably swung the tail from side to side to deter would-be predators. The big plates along the back, though, you're right, they're almost certainly not for defence. That's an old idea. It used to be thought they were there somehow to ward off predators. But when you look at these plates close up, you realise they're really thin. It's almost like having a row of potato chips stuck along your back. It's not going to put off anything that can really seriously bite them. So they're probably for something else. One idea is that they're actually for temperature regulation, because they're big plates. In Sophie, the biggest plate's about 75, 76 centimetres long. So there's a big area for them to warm up or cool down. So that might have affected Sophie's temperature. It could also just be for display. It could be the equivalent of a peacock's tail, just for showing off, showing you're in good healthy condition and signalling to other members of the same species. And most people who work on stegosaurs tend to lean towards that explanation these days. And they're nothing more than a big showy sign to show that I'm a big healthy adult stegosaurus. So they are very visually obvious. You can see them from a long way away, which gives some credit to that idea. But in terms of them putting off a nasty Allosaurus that wants to have them for lunch, probably not so good. But just give them a bit of extra crunch.
And when roughly was Sophie running around Wyoming?
So Sophie would have been running around during the late part of what we call the Jurassic period. So she's probably about 150-odd million years old. We're actually doing some work at the quarry at the moment to try and get a precise date for how old she is. But somewhere about 150.
And what other science are you doing apart from assembling her?
We're trying to do a lot with the skeleton. It's very rare to get a complete three-dimensional Stegosaurus. Although it's a very familiar dinosaur to a lot of people, it's actually pretty rare. There are only around half a dozen partially complete, semi-complete skeletons known from the western part of North America where the animal lived. So we're doing as much as we possibly can before we put her onto display. So we're updating the actual anatomy of Stegosaurus, which hasn't been updated for over 100 years. We're using CT scanning to peer into her skull to have a look at what her brain and her ears look like, and also to reconstruct the skull to see if we can say something sensible about how hard she could bite, for example. We've CT scanned the plates and the tail spines, and we're hoping to do some engineering analyses on those to see just how strong they really are. And in addition, we're also looking at various aspects of how she walked around, things like that. So we're doing as much as we possibly can to really give Stegosaurus a bit of an update, because it's an animal that very few people have worked on. So there have been few small bits of pieces of work, but we have a big program to try and squeeze as much science out of her as we possibly can before she then goes on permanent display.
And the public's going to be rapt, aren't they?
I really hope so. It's a big iconic dinosaur. We're putting her in a nice central part of the museum where she'll really be put on full display. I hope that lots of people come and see her and enjoy it.
Another euphoric scientist, Professor Paul Barrett at the Natural History Museum in London. And his professorship, by the way, is at the Witwatersrand University in South Africa, which is where Vanessa Hayes comes from, though now she studies genomes and prostates at the Garvan Institute in Sydney. She is tracing the possible clues to prostate cancer in our ancient human or hominid genomes, which predate those that left Africa thousands of years ago. There are still various ancestral sets of DNA in South Africa stretching back 200,000 years, or even more recent genomes which could tell the tale.
The theory is we only come from about 200 people that left Africa, creating all Europeans and Asians as today. So they haven't just gone through any significantly large major bottleneck and have continued going through natural variation without having that reduction in the genetic pool.
Is it true, and I was rather surprised to read this, that those genomes of ancient people in Africa were only examined in bits rather than whole genomes?
Correct. So the particular skeleton that we sequenced recently, we were actually looking for a skeleton that predates any archaeological evidence. Now, a reason for this is we are still trying to define where the origins of mankind are and the history really of Africa, because this is the history of all of us. And what we know through archaeological evidence is that people that we call Ku people or Kukwadi speakers migrated down from, we assume, somewhere in Central Africa all the way down to the southern tip where Cape Town is today. And the evidence is based on sheep. So there are archaeological remains of sheep being brought down from Central Africa all the way through Namibia, down the west coast, which is very treacherous, and into Cape Town. And these tell us that people arrived into the northern part of Namibia across the Angolan border around 2,000 to 2,200 years ago. Now, we know that Southern Africa was a significant area for early modern humans because there is the footprints of Eve on the west coast north of Cape Town, which are dated to around 1,117,000 years ago and are the oldest evidence of walking modern human footprints. There's Bloemhof Cave, which is also at the southern tip, more along the east coast, and that is rich from 70,000 to around 100,000 years ago of artifacts like tools, ornaments, and of course there's also some ancient skulls dating around 37,000 years. The problem with the human remains in the region is the acidity of the soil, and the climate is very, very harsh. So in comparison to, for example, sequencing a Neanderthal or sequencing the Ice Age man that have been kept in nice cold climates, the DNA gets very degraded in these skeletons. So we were very lucky in 2010 when the archaeologist Andrew Smith from the University of Cape Town contacted me and said, I know that you're very interested in using DNA to study the early Southern Africans. We found a skeleton. We believe this is a Kusan individual. What must I do? And that was very, very important.
One thing that is still slightly puzzling, here you are looking for ancient DNA. How does that tie up to your prostate interests?
Well, the ancient DNA provides for us a baseline. The problem with the human reference is it represents recently diverged populations. And this is very important if we want to compare against our ancestral roots. When we do this in science and in genomics, we usually use the chimp. And the problem with that is the chimp and us, although we shared a common ancestor, that common ancestor was around 6.5 to 7 million years ago. So although we are very similar to the chimp, it's probably not the ideal candidate to use. Neither is the Neanderthal, because we separated around 500,000 years ago. So what would be the best is if we really came home to us as modern humans and found individuals that were earlier diverged in the history of us and use that to extend our knowledge about what was our ancestral line. So how prostate cancer comes into this and why we chose to work with the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, because a lot of people are very unaware of how significant prostate cancer is within Africa. And in fact, people are very unaware. And if you just take South Africa, for example, the average life expectancy for a man is around 45 years of age. So therefore, prostate cancer is not seen as a significant worry. And also in a country where infectious diseases like HIV, malaria, and TB are such a huge impact on the population, prostate cancer is not ignored, but it's obviously not that important. But what we have been doing is studying prostate cancer within the region and found it to be highly aggressive and highly significant in people that are from African ancestry. And we base these studies on what has come out of the United States to show that the most significant risk factors of prostate cancer is one, older age, as we know. Secondly, a family history. You've got a higher risk of getting prostate cancer. And the third is if you have an African ancestry. And these are highly significant. But no one has gone back to Africa to understand where this comes from. And it really points to DNA. And one of the reasons also we chose the Archbishop Desmond Tutu is he has prostate cancer. So did Nelson Mandela. People were not aware of this. And so we can use the Archbishop's DNA profile, not just to have sequenced a Southern African, but also to start using this as a baseline to start to understand this African ancestral route to prostate cancer. And for this, we have a very large Southern African prostate cancer study now. We've been collecting men from rural areas who have prostate cancer, because ultimately this link to Africa helps everybody globally. Because as we all came from Africa, so did likely prostate cancer come from Africa.
What put you next to Michelle Obama in the news?
Yes, that was amusing. So one of the things that we're learning from these ancient genomes is about the concept that people have about the paleo diet. The paleo diet is meant to represent the hunter-gatherer diet, but I think the problem is that people are probably misinterpreting what the hunter-gatherer diet really was about, mixing it with the concept that meat is eaten every day, which certainly is not the case in the hunter-gatherer populations I work with. To actually go out on the hunt, it has to be a very, very calculated balance of your energy expenditure and energy gain. So you only hunt when you have enough energy and you plan that hunt. And that hunt will probably only happen if you're lucky once every 2 weeks and maybe only once a month. The idea behind it is that our DNA profile determines that we should live in that way because for 190,000 years we were hunter-gatherers. What Michelle Obama is saying is, because we should eat a paleo diet, we should change the eating habits of American children at the schools. Now, that I completely agree with. The diets, modern diet, especially in the United States, is not probably the healthiest and not probably not in Australia either. So educating children about eating naturally, I have no problem with that. Whether it should be the paleo diet, I think we have to be careful of that because we have had 10,000 years of adaptation to agriculture. Have we adapted to grains? Because the true hunter-gatherer can't eat grains either. They have not adapted to drinking milk, but yet most Europeans have adapted to drinking milk. So we've got to take these adaptations into consideration.
Professor Vanessa Hayes is at the Garvan Institute in Sydney, and this is The Science Show on RN. Kudi Bo solar have come from bats. So how do you monitor huge bat populations to get a feel for such trends? And how can scientists work with us to crunch the big numbers? Kate Jones is Chair of Ecology at University College in London. What sort of bats are you looking for and where?
I'm trying to design new technologies to monitor bat populations better. So all bats everywhere.
That sounds impossible.
Well, bats use ultrasonic sound to navigate and to locate and detect insects or pollen or fruit. So about 1,000 out of the 1,200 species will use echolocation. So it's quite a good kind of indicator of bat activity.
So if you sample the sound and you've got these recorders on all over the place for a long time, you can then, if you're lucky, work out how many bats there have been in a particular area. But how do you pin down the numbers?
Those are really tricky questions, actually. So you can imagine if you've got lots and lots of calls, because you've got lots and lots of data, you don't know what species it is. So we've been developing models to try to help us understand that. And these kind of like a speech recognition algorithms, the things that you use like with Siri, for example, on your iPhone. And so as with many other fields, this idea of big data and you need to find the patterns in is becoming more and more prevalent in wildlife conservation, biodiversity monitoring.
And you can outsource it, can you? You can actually get people who are not necessarily scientists, citizen scientists, to help you in your quest.
Yeah, so you can kind of get them involved in different ways, I think. And more recent kind of thinking on citizen science is being a bit more democratic. So it's not like the scientist saying, you there, you do some work for me, but it's more like involving them in the whole process. So going into an area and talking to the people about what they need or want from their local area or what want to monitor, and then using your expertise to help them design it. So a really interesting study that blew me away the other day was someone from UCL went into a school and it was an 8-year-old classroom. And he helped them set up this experiment with bees. And so they did all the bee experiment themselves and they showed that bees like different coloured plants to go to. And the children wrote up the study themselves and they did little figures, the hand-drawn figures. And it got published in Biology Letters in Proceedings of the Royal Society. And he did an overview, the scientist did an overview of what the main finding was. But it was real science done by 8-year-olds. And I think that's amazing. And science is just not just for these ivory towers. And I think the more we democratize it, good, strong science, and it's hard to design science like that, can make a really big difference. So I have a citizen science project which is helping us develop a speech recognition algorithm for bats. And it's called Bat Detective. And so you can log on and look at our recordings that we've made and we need help with. And they can kind of help us develop these ground truth data. They mark on when they hear a bat call. So it's actually quite fun.
Where are the bats being recorded? Which countries?
These recordings that we put on Bat Detective are from IBATS projects in Ukraine, in Russia, in Romania and Bulgaria and Japan and Mongolia. So all these places that we've been working with the local people to train and donate equipment, and they record the information and we try to develop these tools that they then can use to analyze it.
What are you doing about the emergence of diseases? And I'm thinking of things like Ebola, where some people have suggested as you encroach on forests and you get creatures leaking out where they didn't go out before and bringing certain diseases with them that have been perfectly fine with the animals, but once they reach us, we have a problem. What's the Ebola story, for example?
Yeah, well, I think it was a bit of a strange leap, but so the outbreak of Ebola is one of the consequences of going into habitats which we haven't been in before, having more access to those areas and hunting animals which were consumed at a low quantity but now at a higher quantity because there are more people and more access to this bushmeat markets.
So which do you think, which animal did Ebola come out of?
I think there's some debate, but fruit bats are definitely one of the candidates for Ebola. It's tricky because bats also provide a huge number of ecosystem services like pollination and seed dispersal. So it's a very difficult thing to talk about because they are essential to healthy forests and regeneration of forests and pollinating crops that are really important to us. And yet they also harbour some these diseases which are also very dangerous, you know. So it's a real dilemma, really. But it's because of our actions which have caused us to become more in contact with these species which we're not used to being in contact with. And it's like an invasive species, really. So a pathogen would jumps from these hosts, which are just minding their own business, into a human. And then these diseases may or may not spread. But we don't really understand those mechanisms very well. And that's what we've been trying to work on through monitoring different changes and how bat populations or other species will change. So one of our other projects is on Lassa. So Lassa is a similar disease to Ebola, but not as virulent. It's also in West Africa, but the host is a rat. So this rat is found out throughout sub-Saharan Africa, but Lassa fever is only found in humans in West Africa. So trying to understand the restricted distribution given the host is found everywhere is a real challenge. And you're not going to understand Lassa dynamics unless you start to understand more about the host. So those are the kinds of things that we're trying to plug. So we're trying to use biodiversity science and ecology in medical science. So that's tricky. It's tricky because I think some medics or epidemiologists don't fully grasp how important the biodiversity, well, I would say that, the biodiversity is in their models. So we're trying to think about how to improve that.
Kate Jones is Head of Ecology and Biodiversity at University College in London, and she's one of those worried about the numbers of our own fruit bats, whose populations are indeed threatened. She mentioned invasive species just now, and one you may not be so familiar with here in Australia is the mosquito fish. This is John Purser in Launceston, where he's Director of the National Centre for Marine Conservation and Resource Sustainability.
Mosquito fish is what's called a Gambusia holbrooki. It's the eastern mosquito fish, and it's got that name because it was introduced around the world to supposedly control mosquitoes and therefore malaria.
And it was introduced here in Australia?
It was introduced in Australia about 1925 and spread around the country and introduced into Tasmania initially, I think, about 1993. It was then eradicated and then reintroduced, we think, about 2000.
How?
I think people just brought it into the state, maybe because they thought it was cute. I don't know. It looks very much like a guppy. Could be used as an aquarium fish, but it was released and put into farm dams.
Could it actually catch mosquitoes?
Well, in effect, the mosquito fish found other things to eat, and the native fish were controlling the mosquito larvae anyway. So the mosquito fish decided to then prey on the native fish and also frog species through their tadpoles.
So this is another cane toad story.
You could look at it that way, yes. Yes, they like the environment, they spread very nicely around the country, and they exist in large numbers in places.
Are they big fish?
No, these are very small fish. They're around about 35 millimetres in the males to about 50 to 60 millimetres in the females, so quite small.
And what's your role in the quest to get rid of them?
Well, my role is that we have an ARC linkage grant with a number of partners, and Jawahar Patel is the lead investigator on the project. We're both from the University of Tasmania, and there are other collaborators from the University of Adelaide, from Inland Fisheries, and we're trying a new technique called the Trojan Y technique to control the animal.
How?
Well, a lot of the control measures that have been used, and there have been a lot of people working on this in Tasmania for a while, we don't want it to spread around the state, have used manual methods and traps, and to attract the animals to the traps. We also have a group of volunteers who have spent a lot of time trying to collect the fish from the waterways, and we're trying to minimise the spread of this fish from around Launceston. The way of doing it in this new project is to introduce what we call a Trojan Y chromosome into the reproduction so that it biases the population towards males.
And if you've got more males, then what?
Well, they find it hard to breed because we don't have enough females. And so because of that sex bias, they will hopefully disappear over time. You have to keep recruiting into the population with these Trojan Y females. They're basically females that carry two Y chromosomes that make them males genetically.
Do you have to make them 2Y, or do they grow that way anyway, except in smaller numbers?
The way that we make them would be to use female hormones to feminize males. And so you start off with a male, feminize that one, and then you cross that sex-reversed fish with another male. You'll end up then with a combination of females, males, and what we call super males, which have two Y chromosomes. So the females are 2X, the males are XY, and the super males are 2Ys. We then feed them a female hormone, feminize those, and produce a fish that looks like a female, but actually is a super male.
Right. No wonder the fish are confused with various genders floating around. Of course, all this depends on the fact that there won't be sufficient numbers of real females in the population who can just absorb whatever happens and carry on breeding regardless.
Yes, that's always the risk associated with this approach, is that you have to keep repopulating the area with these Trojan Y fish so that you can keep that sex bias going. But hopefully over time it will diminish that population.
Have you released any of these Franken mosquito fish yet?
No, we haven't got that far yet. No, what we're looking for at the moment is really the sex reversal process so that we can in fact produce these Trojan Y females.
Well, good luck. John Purser in Launceston, where he directs the National Centre for Marine Conservation and Resource Sustainability. And still on invasive species, here is this week's PhD, Tim Doherty at Edith Cowan University in the West.
Australia is home to extraordinary and unique mammals. More than 300 species of land-dwelling mammals call Australia home. 85% of them are found nowhere else in the world. Shockingly, though, 30 of these species have become extinct since Europeans arrived in Australia just over 200 years ago. This is a rate of loss of one or two species each decade, and it equates to the worst mammal extinction record anywhere in the world. Sadly, that's not the end of the story in Australia. Many other mammals have also suffered population declines, and there is a real risk that some of those species too will go extinct in our lifetimes, never to be seen again, ever. The main culprit for these declines is predation by the introduced red fox and feral cat. Feral cats have recently been named as the biggest threat to our endangered mammals. They are literally eating their way through our wildlife. And this is where my research comes in. I study the ecology of feral cats in Charles Darwin Reserve in remote WA. It's 450 kilometres northeast of Perth. I'm also looking at Australia-wide patterns in cat habitat use and exactly what they are eating. Cats live in every type of habitat, from deserts to forests and all the way up to alpine areas. There may be more than 10 million feral cats in Australia, killing tens of millions of mammals, birds and reptiles each day. To identify exactly what cats have been eating, we dissect either their feces or stomach contents to look at the prey remains under a microscope. A bit of a messy job for some lucky researchers. One part of my research has been done with the help of some colleagues. We've been documenting what species of native animals cats eat and how their diet varies across the continent. To do this, we collated 50 studies from across the country that examine the diet of feral cats. We found that cats predate at least 123 different bird species, 85 mammals, 157 reptiles, and 21 frogs. It seems they're not fussy. If they can kill it, they'll eat it. They also eat insects, but no one seems to care about them. And it's likely that there are many other species out there that cats kill and eat that we just don't know about yet. We found that reptiles are the main victims of cats living in desert regions, whereas medium-sized mammals, such as possums and bandicoots, are eaten most frequently in the southeast. Rabbits are also eaten frequently by cats, but if rabbits are absent from an area or become less numerous, cats will then switch to native mammals. What this suggests is that land managers should use a multi-species approach for pest animal control. Because if rabbits are culled but cat populations are not reduced at the same time, it's likely that cats will then prey even more heavily on the native mammals. Controlling feral cats presents land managers with a formidable challenge, and understanding their movements and feeding ecology will aid in reducing their harmful impact on our threatened fauna. Sadly, though, it's likely we will never rid Australia of these introduced killing machines, and we can only imagine what the country would look like if they'd never been brought here.
Now, there's a thought experiment. By the way, there's more on cats in Background Briefing from a few weeks ago, a special on feral cats by Greg Borschmann, a link on the SciShow website. Tim Doherty at Edith Cowan University in Perth, and this is the Science Show on RN, where last week we brought you the Bragg Prize for Science Writing, won by Joe Chandler, with Professor Frank Bowden, one of the runners-up. Here they are being interviewed by the editor of Best Australian Science Writing, Ashley Hay, with a particularly tricky opening question to put them on the spot.
So I want to start by asking them both now, in general, for their thoughts on this great big statement. Does science give us our best chance for a desirable future? And Joe, I'm going to annoy you first.
When you floated this topic, I was giving it a little bit of thought last night as I was sort of contemplating it whilst cooking the dinner. My partner showed me a viral video that he had come across during the day, and I tend to avoid these things because I'm trying to earn a living and I try and turn off these distractions when I can. But this little video was a tiny little clip. It was a small baby, an infant, maybe 6-8 months old, and he's sitting on his mother's lap, and a doctor is fitting a hearing aid to this profoundly deaf child for the first time. And initially this child is grizzling and protesting at this thing being stuck in his ear, and then suddenly he hears his mother's voice for the first time. And it is the most profoundly moving thing to see. And this child's face is just glowing and his world has just transformed utterly. Mm. And I thought, well, there we have the answer. It is that utterly changes the future, the science and the technology that delivered that moment. But even without that, I might be a Philistine. I suspect I am. But I do powerfully believe that in the world that we've created, and in John Cook's piece, you know, he sort of sums up, I guess, the climate moment here and now, and says the bottom line is that we are handing to our children an infinitely more dangerous world than the one our parents gave us. And I can't think of another moment in human history where we've been better equipped with the science to change and address the things that are occurring around us and to be able to respond to the agricultural challenges and the human habitational challenges, wild weather events, sea level rise, ocean acidification, so many challenges that will utterly change the future and the prospects of the next generation, let alone the one after that. And without science, all the rest is kind of icing. I just can't imagine that we get to have a world where we can explore music and the arts in the way that we have historically if we're challenged in our survival every day.
Frank, I want to ask you now as well how the question of science and our desirable future, how that resonates with you as a medical practitioner and as a teacher.
Ash, the issue of the future in terms of a scientific solution worries me. I think we have the most extraordinary technology. We have the most amazing computers. We've got things that I couldn't have dreamt of when I was a child, now sitting in my pocket, you know, a more powerful computer than most of us have ever had. But what worries me is that we're looking to science to solve problems which we are making through politics and economics and through lack of education. And my fear is that if we look at an example of antibiotics in my area, we're just about to run out of antibiotics, and I'm sitting next to somebody who knows firsthand how precious the resource of antibiotics is. And while I'm worrying that the world is panicking about Ebola, no one's taking too much worry about a disease which affects hundreds of thousands of people and which is very close to moving to Australia. And we'll worry about it then because now it's in Australia. So as a first world country, we will worry. I have no doubt that once the pharmaceutical industry start paying attention to antibiotics again, that we will find solutions to a lot of the multi-resistant bacteria that we're dealing with. And recently a new TB drug was released, which looks very good. It got a few side effects, but looks very powerful. There's no scientific barrier to solving the problem. The problem is one, really, of will and of politics. We have to educate the population and we have to educate the medical profession and people who work in this area about antibiotics, about how precious they are. It's taken a long time, but it's exactly the same as climate science. We've been banging on about resistance for 20 years and no one believes it. No one's taken very much notice of it until it happens. With exponential growth, you know, you're one day away from, if the doubling time is a day, you know, you're one day away from the end of antibiotics. What I don't understand is the lack of science's ability to create a human imagination that truly sees the possibilities of the future.
Is that a case then where it's not just about people having a sort of broader scientific education, but having an education about scientific method itself, about how science weighs up the option?
C.P. Snow's lecture in 1959, The Two Cultures, summed it up. I mean, Snow, an author, a physicist, was very upset that his humanities friends didn't know the second law of thermodynamics. Now, I wouldn't expect people to say that that's the marker of whether you're scientifically literate.
Thank you.
But, but it's a 50-year-old conundrum that if we ignore the vast majority of people who are simply the consumers of scientific knowledge, if we ignore them and treat them as though they're separate to this argument, then we face the problems that we have today. I think it's 40% of Americans do not believe in evolution. You know, they are an educated country. And yet 40% of people do not see the fundamental tenet of biological science as being true. So our job, one of the reasons that I've started to write for a general audience rather than a specialised audience, is because I feel that it's so important for us to present in a way that the intelligent layperson can read about science and not necessarily ever make science, but to be able to understand the process. We have to talk to people about the scientific method.
I want to ask you both a little bit about the role of science in the two separate pieces. And Joe, I want to start with yours. The subtitle of the piece is A Medical Souvenir, and it is a very gripping account of your diagnosis with tuberculosis after a trip to PNG. And one of the most striking lines for me came from the way you laid utterly bare the difference between your diagnosis of TB in Melbourne and a diagnosis of TB in somewhere like Daru in PNG, that someone in PNG, you wrote, might ever realise the most pared-back version of my treatment is unimaginable.
I'm not a scientist. My role as a journalist on and off over the last 25 years, I consider myself a storyteller. So I place myself as a broker between smart people who do important things and a general audience and try and make them teach me as much as they can about the detail of it, take it off into my cave, process it, play with it, reword it and turn it into something that might be accessible and give it back to them. It's often this very dynamic process where I'll go back and forth, and I've always done that, and it's the motivation for telling those stories in that way was, as Frank was saying, was about trying to reach an audience with really gripping, compelling, fabulous adventure stories or stories that would define and reshape our lives, and trying to not frighten the horses in that process. So you kind of sneak up from behind with the narrative or the personality or the character-driven story about how they got the ice that tells us what occurred 500,000 years ago and what's in the bubbles of that, and how they, you know, these gripping stories about radar in DC-3s floating over the top backwards and forwards over the Antarctic ice to figure out the shape of the trough underneath so that we can figure out how the sea levels will change. And so these are really difficult scientific stories, but if you can lure someone in with this great personal yarn, that is what's always been the thing that kept us alive as civilizations. We needed shelter, we needed food, and we needed stories that told us where it was safe to eat, where it was safe to fish, how to make a family together, how to keep the neighbourhood nice, you know, cautionary tales. Before science, it was through that narrative of human storytelling. And so I just strip it back to real people and real stories. So when I found myself sitting in a hospital bed, very sick, with something that I had seen many people die of, and I'll never know, but I think the day that I picked up this bug, which ironically I think was the day I was supposed to come here and pick up an award a couple of years ago, was when we met this woman, this mother, mourning her 19-year-old daughter in the morgue, and this her daughter had just died the most terrible, agonising death. Mm. And then we travelled with her family back to the community. And it's not just the story of the death, it's to look at that community and all the little kids who are on their mother's hips, living in the middle of a mud flat, who have lost their mobility because they couldn't get any treatment for TB meningitis. So their brains are damaged, their capacity to move is gone. They're in a community without wheelchairs, without ramps, without any sort of physio possibility, with no respite for them and their mothers. And so I guess I wanted to draw that whole reality together. And I felt, I guess, profoundly guilty that I did have access to this treatment. So this was my chance to be the character that I often go looking for in science, the one who finds themselves in this landscape and is trying to figure it out. And so that's why I put myself in the middle of it and then use that to explain the scientific challenge of diagnosis. I mean, in TB, they say that the diagnostics date from, what, 1890, a sputum test, vaccines from the 60s or thereabouts. It just seems astonishing that they're, you know, for the reasons that Frank discussed, these, because it's a disease of poverty and it exists on the margins of first world societies, there's no money in it. So I guess I wanted to lay out that reality of, well, how do you get diagnostics into these environments, the challenges of doing that, and the spill-on effects of the fact that if 9 out of every 10 beds in a developing country is occupied by a TB patient, other patients are denied treatment because they suck up every resource in the system, and that's what's occurring now with TB right through that, you know, our nearest neighbour.
Frank, I wanted to ask now if you could wade in against the very human assumption many of us make that all medical screening is a force for good.
Before I went to medical school, I thought screening for cancer must be a good thing. Pap smears were starting to appear. I mean, the pap smear had been around since 1948, 49, but in the 1970s and 80s across the developed world, people started coordinated pap smear programs, and cervical cancer screening in the developed world led to substantial decreases in the mortality. So people said it's a good thing. The newly instituted bowel cancer screening program in Australia has got a very strong evidence base to say that it does prevent death, and I think that we will find that that's sustainable. But that doesn't mean, therefore, that every cancer can be screened for. And it's quite well known that you cannot screen for lung cancer with a simple chest X-ray, that you just don't find enough true cancers. You have to operate on people unnecessarily. It just doesn't work. Recently, it's been shown that you can screen for lung cancer in smokers with CT scans, and that probably works. But there's a first world answer, if ever there was one, and for a cancer that's completely preventable.
Yes.
So the idea is, does screening work? You have to meet a number of WHO criteria. And across the world, no formal screening committee says that you should screen for prostate cancer. And yet, in Australia, probably more men screened for prostate cancer than there are women screened with mammography. And that varies from state to state and place to place. But clearly, there's been a vote from the population, from GPs in particular who drive the screening, that prostate cancer screening should be done. And we don't really know how much money we spend on it each year. Why does an infectious disease doctor take an interest in cancer? Get out of my space, says the oncologist, says the urologist, I can tell you that. The reason is because I sit at the bottom of a funnel that takes all of the people with serious infections. We see the things together that an individual practitioner may not see. And about 10 or 12 years ago, we looked at the rate of prostate biopsy-related infections in the ACT, and we found that about 1% of the screening was leading to a bacteremia. That's a bloodstream infection. And most doctors don't know this, but if you get a germ in your blood, if you get E. coli or a Staph aureus in your blood so that I can take a sample and culture it from you, the chance of dying, the lowest estimate for a chance of dying is 5%, and the highest estimate is about 25%. And if you get septic shock from that, it's about 50%.
Right.
The risk of dying from a heart attack, if you make it to hospital, is less than 5%. So getting a germ in your blood is worse than having a heart attack, and people don't quite see the significance of that, but we do because we see the consequences. So we looked at the rates of biopsies and we saw an increasing number of people were getting infections that were resistant, not very much in Australia, but people from coming back from overseas mm-hmm. were. And at that stage, I started teaching my medical students about this because I thought this is a really interesting topic because we've got practice, which drives their learning. You know, we can talk to students for as long as we like. We can present them with evidence, but the real teacher is the mentor that they have. So they go into general practice, sit next to a GP who's screened people, and they'll come back and talk to me afterwards and say, well, we should do this. This is very, very good thing to do. And so for years, I've been watching the evidence mount against prostate cancer screening, and I've watched the resistance from the people who have invested, and I'm not meaning from a financial point of view, but emotionally, professionally, into the idea that screening is good. It's Movember at the moment. I mean, all the blokes who are growing a moustache at the moment, apart from the crime against fashion that is, they are saying about prostate cancer screening. Now, the message is not quite as explicit today as it used to be, but it used to be a very explicit message that this is about prostate cancer screening. Be a real man and get a screen. And the advertising that I talk about in the start of the piece is a very powerful, beautiful piece of advertising that gets a group of young people and a wiggle, so it must be serious, who say prostate cancer could affect you, could affect me. And the fact is, it doesn't. It's an incredibly rare disease below 40. It starts to increase slightly at 50. And if you live long enough, if you can live to 100, you'll almost certainly have prostate cancer. So this whole issue of should we screen, should we intervene, is such a central part of modern medicine that to me it's something that you've got to take people back to the beginning and say, let's look at why we screen for cancer. The bottom line is that we will be driven to stop prostate biopsies because anyone who travels to Southeast Asia carries a 50% chance of bringing back a multi-drug resistant E. coli or Klebsiella, mm-hmm. which will not be treatable by antibiotics. And if that happens, then suddenly everybody starts to panic. And that is going to change the way people screen. It's already doing it. Urologists are now doing MRIs. Now, there's no evidence yet to suggest whether that's better or worse and whether it's effective.
But it's not going to give you an infection
But you won't get an infection in your blood if that's the case. And the final thing is that prostate cancer is a serious problem for an ageing population, but we do not have good treatments for it. And the radical prostatectomy, which is taken up by so many people, if you really look into it, not only is it associated with serious side effects, and these are lifelong debilitating side effects for a significant proportion of men, even in the best hands, doesn't matter who does it, it will happen. Only 3% of people, and this is from the best study that will ever be done on this, only 3% of people actually will be prevented from dying from prostate cancer from it. And when you look at the two groups of people who are screened and not screened, although you prevent a small group of men from dying from prostate cancer, overall the mortality is the same in both groups.
Right.
They die of something else.
They die of something else. Which is not the happy ending I wanted to leave you all on, but I would like to thank both of our writers for being willing to sort of think aloud around the idea of science and the future and about their own pieces for us. And to again thank all of you for coming along for the launch of the book tonight. I hope you enjoy it and thank you.
Ashley Hay, who this year edited the book of the best Australian science writing, and she spoke to two of the authors, Bragg Prize winner Joe Chandler and Professor Frank Bowden from the Australian National University in Canberra. The book is published by New South Press, and as David Gonski said last week, a terrific read. Next week on The Science Show, examining the genomes of babies to see what may be wrong with them and trying to do something about it. And what was life like 5,000 years ago? Some of us can remember. And then there's Catalyst, 8 p.m. on Thursday, ABC Television, The Great Tasmanian Poo Hunt, The Search for Feral Foxes. Production for The Science Show by David Fisher and Lila Schunner. I'm Robin Williams.
If only our political masters took a lead from science fiction. On Future Tense, meet the political scientist teaching sci-fi as well as Marx. Then there's the sci-fi apologist and overcoming the gender divide.
What really good science fiction does is it takes the world as we know it and it tweaks some fundamental little constant. And that tweak, that change, forces you to redefine what's normal.
That's Future Tense, and you can download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.